RCR with Paul Brennan.
Joining us now on RCR is Mike Adams, a.k.a. Health Ranger. You've heard that name before. Author, inventor, publisher, prepper, podcaster, platform architect for free speech. He also publishes naturalnews.com, a health freedom news site, and founded Brightian.com, a free speech video platform. We've asked him on to talk about the big picture. Mike, it's so nice to have you on RCR. Thank you for making some time to beam in all the way to New Zealand, bottom of the world, next stop Antarctica from the US. So great to meet you.
I'm honored to join you. Thanks for the invitation. I really look forward to this. It's just great to be able to join you.
All right. Big picture question first, if you don't mind, because as I say, I've been aware of you for quite some time. I know that you have plugged into and talked to so many people in so many different fields. In your assessment, and this might be a little sort of grim to start with, but on the doomsday clock, how close is it to midnight?
Oh, well, you know, unfortunately, the doomsday clock scenarios are not really linear. It's kind of like if the wrong person pulls the wrong trigger, then it's definitely doomsday. And I think we all know who that person is right now. Yet we could avoid that. You know, we really could. We could be facing a future of much greater abundance. Maybe humanity could learn some important lessons. I know that's what you and I are both about to a large extent. Whether we'll get there, I'm not sure. I mean, we're clearly on the edge of global self-destruction, but it doesn't have to happen. So we need to be prepared in case the craziest people do the craziest things. And they've proven they're willing to do that, by the way.
It's kind of craziness on such an epic scale at the moment. Every bit about it, I mean, obviously we're watching every move that comes out of the US, every move that comes out of the Middle East, all of that. The rhetoric, the diplomacy, if you could call it that. All those things that we used to kind of rely on for sort of normal relations and normality seem to have kind of just been, I don't know, the ejection seat handles being pulled somewhere.
Yeah, well, I can imagine that perhaps the way it feels for you in New Zealand, watching the actions of the United States and feeling powerless, I want to tell you, I feel the same way from Texas. I feel powerless to what my own leadership is doing in the world and feeling like there's nothing that we can do to stop it. I mean, you and I, we work to educate people. We try to empower and uplift people, and we teach resilience and sustainability, self-reliance. But at the end of the day, we are not in control of the big factors that can happen. You know, money, war, nuclear war, energy, all those things. And so we have to just be ready to ride that out, whatever happens.
So what we're seeing at the moment is it fundamentally a war of aggression, physical confrontation, or is it ultimately economic? What do you think?
Ultimately it does become economic. I was just on a show talking about the economic consequences of the energy shortages. And if this conflict continues, I'm talking about the Middle East conflict, of course, if this continues for many more months, and if more energy infrastructure is destroyed by both sides, that is rendering the gas exports out of Qatar energy, rendering that, you know, damaged for years, or damaging more oil wells or more of the ports through which the exports take place, that puts us on a multi-year timeline of real global mass famine. And I don't mean every single country, but hundreds of millions, if not billions of people would be affected by that because they're living on the edge. In many countries, the extreme poverty in places like Sudan, Yemen, a lot of the population of India, populations in Bangladesh, populations in Ethiopia, and so on. They don't live in the conditions that perhaps you and I live in. You know, New Zealand is famous for having food abundance, and so is Texas. We can probably figure out how to grow enough food, but not everybody's in that situation.
Your leadership knows that. Surely.
They don't care. They
don't care?
They have other priorities. And I've said the most humanitarian thing, in my view, that Trump could do right now is to leave the Middle East. Because we're talking about the number of people dying from famine in 2027 in the millions, a number that would dwarf the Holocaust of World War II in terms of actual deaths. I mean, this is a food Holocaust in the making right now. And every day that the strait stays closed, this gets worse and worse. And it's easy for, I think, Trump administration officials to ignore it because we don't feel the consequences today. But those consequences will be felt tomorrow. I mean, you know, next year, largely. They're coming, and they are, at some level, inescapable. We need to stop the damage now, restore the flow of fertilizer now. And also, we got to teach people to not depend as much on those inputs also. You know, grow your own food, permaculture, self-reliance, home gardening. That's all important, as you know.
We'll get to that. I listened a day or so ago to an interview you did with Colonel Douglas McGregor, and I've obviously been following him for a while. He's a very interesting commentator with an incredible background. And of course, Operation Freedom, and I think you've referred to it as Freedom, is going. It was fascinating to hear what he had to say about the state of the US military and how there's they've missed something along the way and have still using forces that are sort of embedded in a kind of World War II mentality. And that's being shown up by Iran with their missile sort of defense system and how defensive warfare is kind of being more effective now than offensive warfare. That's a real surprise to hear because I always thought that the US military was, you know, state of the art, all the technology you could ever want, incredible tactics, you know, a long history of fighting wars, successful or not, it's another story. But yet they've turned up with a vintage sort of military, it seems to me, which is not fit for purpose. How did that happen?
Well, I have great respect for Colonel McGregor, as you do. And I think he's got great wisdom on this. And remember, he's a veteran who commanded tank squadrons in the first Gulf War back in the early 1990s. Yeah. And so he saw the capabilities of the U.S. military at that time. And the dominance of the U.S. military was undisputed in the early 1990s and, frankly, in the early 2000s as well. But what changed? And think about the history of warfare, how it changed with the invention of the musket. And then later on the rifle and then the mass produced rifle, especially like American history, you know, how were we able to fight the British Empire and create our own new nation? It was because of the decentralization of new weapons technology, those weapons appearing in the hands of everyday people. Well, today in Iran, that's a kamikaze drone launched from the back of a pickup truck. You know, a drone that can be distributed or even manufactured for a few thousand dollars or maybe a few tens of thousands of dollars equivalent, or that maybe Iran is even getting these drones given to them by other countries, possibly. And you can carry these in a vehicle. You can hide them in a cave. You can, you know, you can launch them from almost anywhere. You don't need an Air Force. You don't need a Navy to control the geography that your country is adjacent to, which is the Strait of Hormuz. And remember, I know your audience is aware of this, but the 5,000 years of Persian history is relevant here. You're not going to dislodge Persia from Persia. You know, probably not going to happen. And you can't bomb them into ignorance of math and engineering. You know, bomb them all you want. They can still make drones and they can launch drones and they can harass ships in the Strait. So I've said it many times that the Strait of Hormuz will not be, quote, open. It will not be passable in a routine way until Iran agrees to it. That's it. And so far, that has been proven true. No matter what the U.S. Navy does, no matter what the Pentagon does, no matter how crazy Hegseth acts on any given day, no matter how much he screams and shouts, you can't change geography. And now the mass proliferation of these decentralized low-cost weapons has changed the nature of warfare, which is what Colonel McGregor was speaking about. And now an aircraft carrier is not the dominant force. It's just a giant floating target. That's where we are.
And that forces a potential loss of face if Trump has to, well, back down as a way of putting it, but withdraw from the situation, because you're basically admitting that that your tools, we told you they were exceptional, they're not so exceptional anymore. That is another complication and de-escalation, isn't it?
I think that reputation of U.S. military dominance has already been lost. It's gone. In fact, I've spoken with people about this. I know for a fact that in China, their military leaders are now recalibrating all of their defensive plans based on the fact that the U.S. military is now perceived as less capable than ever in the history of our country. Other countries are recalibrating. Russia, certainly Iran itself, and also Yemen, etc. But the other part of this is that it was apparent even before this current war that U.S. anti-air defense systems, you know, Patriot missiles in particular, did not function, you know, hardly at all, with an interception rate, according to some experts like Ted Postol, an interception rate of only maybe 5 or 10%, which means 90% of the incoming missiles make it through. And we actually saw that in the exchange of kinetic weapons between Iran and Israel last summer. So even then, the reputation of the U.S. military was in the dumps. And that's why, by the way, the background I have here shows the dollar in trouble. That's the kind of montage, is the sort of the sinking U.S. dollar. Because if you can't project naval power around the world, then your currency begins to lose participation. The same thing happened to the British Empire, you know, more than a century ago. This is what's happening to the U.S. empire right now on an accelerated timetable.
We hear a lot about the influence of Israel. Is Israel a significant driver of this, or is it what you've just touched on, and that is the demise of, I think they call it the petrodollar, right? And the power that U.S. currency has. I'm sort of kind of confused on if it is one or the other or a mixture of both.
Well, my perception as an American is that our administration under Trump prioritizes the needs of Israel over the needs of the United States. And so whatever Israel wants, Israel gets. And right now that is, you know, war with Iran. And so if anything, Israel is using the United States or influencing the U.S. to accelerate a timetable of actions that will result in the loss of reputation of the U.S. dollar and the U.S. military. So these things were going to happen anyway, but it's being accelerated because Trump is, at least he's appearing to do the bidding of Netanyahu on a regular basis. And believe me, those of us who are Americans are rather frustrated, even in some cases infuriated by this. And, you know, I voted for Trump twice, not the last time, but the first two times. And yet today I see Trump as a completely different person from the Trump that I voted for years ago. And that's a very common perception.
So you didn't vote for him this time?
No. Yeah. No, for this very reason. I saw that his funding was coming from sources outside the United States, and that his campaign talk was really giving preference to the kind of narration that Netanyahu would support. I saw that before the election, and I said, I'm not voting for Trump. And I was widely attacked for that, by the way. So what? Every person's vote, it's their own choice. And I did participate in the election, and I just withheld my vote that time. And now, according to polls, Trump's popularity has plummeted, but he's not up for re-election again. So the question is, how, like, if you're, it feels like we're all passengers in a car, like we're strapped in the back seat of a car and the driver is drunk.
Yeah.
And swerving on the road, and there's like a mountain pass, and there's an edge, and then fog rolls in, and he's like, let's go faster. That's what it feels like right now, being an American. Trust me.
I don't want to fall back on Colonel McGregor all the time, but another thing I remember him saying is he quite often makes references to, as long as the sport's on, there's a six-pack that's affordable. probably most Americans are not really too interested or aware of the bigger picture that's going on in their name, ultimately. Do you think he's accurate on that?
Yeah, I do. And I've heard stories from people I know who have traveled to other countries recently and have said that when they told people that they were American, they were greeted with shame and verbal attacks simply for being American. And it didn't used to be that way. You know, the American reputation over the years has largely been overall positive, especially in Asia, places like that. That seems to be changing dramatically. You're going to have Americans pretending to be Canadian, you know, when they travel overseas.
You're right. Saying I all the time.
You have to learn how to pronounce the words in a Canadian way.
A boot.
A boot. That's it. This can change. You know, look, this is a problem that the American political process can also take action and it can resolve. The GOP is going to get very concerned. Those are the Republicans in the U.S. system. They're facing a horrific political wipeout in the midterms. And it might be that within the GOP, there's pressure for Trump to resign or to end the war. Or even if he resists, there might be, you know, 25th Amendment type of actions at some point. We're not there yet. But depending on how bad the economic reality gets, even for us in America, you know, high gas prices, high food prices, et cetera. You can't politically survive that. You know, if Americans are paying $8 a gallon for gas or even seven,
well, yeah,
then you're not going to stay in the White House very long. That's just.
Speaking of gas, hydrocarbons, fossil fuels, here we've got 30 days buffer, right? Before we run out of everything. There are some ships on the way. We don't have our own refinery anymore. So we're reliant on refined products who are delivered, you know, the crude, and then I think Singapore and Malaysia, Indonesia, Korea for us.
Wow.
It's really focused back on the essential nature of hydrocarbons, where the narrative has been renewables hammered at us for quite some time now. So do you think it's going to force a sort of like a reassessment of the sort of dreamy, you know, solar, renewable kind of, which can't fulfill the baseload of energy requirements in countries. Do you see that being revisited, or that previous narrative sort of being pushed back to some reality now that fossil fuels are essential? We've got to stick with them no matter what. Otherwise, our standard of living falls to pieces. You know, everything's undone. What's your perception of that?
Yeah, I think a lot of that has already begun, at least here in the States. And part of it was because of the rise of the data centers.
Okay.
The big tech giants pushing data center construction. Basically, the Trump administration threw out the window any kind of concern about, you know, climate, which was, of course, a priority under the Democrats and Joe Biden. But the reality is, you know, as you hinted, and I want to be clear, I support every form of energy abundance. You know, I'm pro every form of energy. If people want to have solar or nuclear or wind or gas, or, you know, whatever. But the truth is that the green energy movement was very deceptive in the fact that the battery technology simply does not exist at scale to be able to time shift green energy sources to make it power the grid. So, you know, the sun only shines a certain number of hours per day. The wind only blows, et cetera. You know, the hydro power depends on rainfall upstream, et cetera. So fossil fuels have always had this important role in providing energy to the grid. And what I saw, especially in Western Europe, was this over the last 15 years was this movement to say, hey, let's end all fossil fuels, shut down all the coal, all the gas. They were tearing down their coal plants. I bet they wish they had them now.
Yeah.
And they were trying to replace that with green energy and finding out that, you know, the green energy doesn't really fulfill all the roles. But there's something else, which is the actual hydrocarbon molecules that natural gas, you know, through the Haber-Bosch process becomes ammonia, which becomes urea and nitrogenous fertilizers. And, you know, you're probably familiar with the fact that, you know, if you're going to take nitrogen out of the atmosphere, N2, you know, the nitrogen atoms are held together very with strong bonds. If you're going to break those bonds, you have to use intense heat and intense pressure. a lot of energy goes into breaking those bonds. And that energy comes from natural gas because it's cheap and abundant when everything's working correctly in the Strait of Hormuz, right? And when Qatar Energy is exporting gas, then you can break apart the nitrogen, you can combine it with hydrogen, and you can create ammonia. And then you have cheap, abundant fertilizer that feeds 4 billion people in the world. Like that's the chemical process that keeps half of humanity currently living. Literally. And so without those hydrocarbons, you can't actually support a population of 8 billion people. And we're about to find out the hard way what happens when you deprive the world of a significant portion of gas and fertilizer. And that's going to end up causing real food scarcity, starvation, and in some countries, famine in 2027.
We also understand that as all this infrastructure in the Middle East runs down, storage limits are hit, and you know the switching equipment off. It's going to take a long time to crank it all back up again. So we're looking at this sort of curve of, nothing plentiful, but constricted supply of everything for longer than maybe the actual problem exists. Then you've got to crank it all up again. So looking out in time, what sort of time span do you think that is? Is it a year or two or even more? Because that will then determine, you know, how many people are at risk, right?
Yes. Yes. I'm so glad you brought this up. The long tail of this is very long. It will be multiple years. And let me give you a specific example. The Qatar Energy Company, when they declared force majeure a few weeks back, they said that two of the gas trains that produce natural gas, they have 14 total, two of them have been destroyed and will take 3 to 5 years to bring back online.
Wow.
So that cut 17% of their energy exports. And remember that about 25% of the world's natural gas comes out of the Persian Gulf, largely from Qatar Energy. So, you know, we can do the math on that. It's not going to end the world. But it's going to raise prices on gas for years to come. It's going to cause shortages, which will cause fertilizer prices to go up and shortages to increase, which will cause farmers to apply less fertilizer to their crops. And what's important to understand about this is that there's a nonlinear response to the loss of fertilizer applications onto crops. For example, corn is a very fertilizer intensive crop. And if you reduce your fertilizer by 10%, you might think, well, you're going to get 10% less yield. That's not true. You can get 30% less yield. You know, it's a nonlinear response. It's actually a shape of a curve. You know, we can all look up the USDA research on that, but it's not a simple formula of, you know, losing 10% and you get 10% lower yield. When fertilizer starts to fall off, you start to get really catastrophic plunges in yields. And this will be a global phenomenon taking place. And what that means is that even if you can grow enough food for the world, you can't grow it at a price that everybody can afford. And there are billions of people who are living just on the edge of food poverty right now. Many of them in India, many of them in Bangladesh, you know, many of them in Africa and some Middle Eastern countries, and also in like think Ethiopia and Yemen and so on. And heck, even Americans are living paycheck to paycheck. 60% of U.S. households are paycheck to paycheck. Can they handle a 40% increase in their food bill? Not without making substitutions or letting something else go, like maybe owning a home, you know?
Or, good luck on that, right?
Right. So the economics of this will have a long tail that lasts for many years to come, extending out beyond 5 years, actually. Although the most intensive part of this, based on the current situation, will be felt in 2027.
Okay. All right. Yeah, you talked about the economics of, I'm thinking family economics, really, the cost of operating families, you know, food, all those things. And that's with a backdrop of obviously the supply chain issues, but also there's another thing, monster, that's sort of lurking, and you alluded to data centers just before, and that is what happens to the earning power of people when AI kind of does more and more its thing. We've been hearing about the potential job categories threatened by that technology. And I guess I'm maybe talking more the Western world, but that may be wrong too. How bad is that potentially?
It's a huge factor. And just for your audience, I am an AI developer. I built the platform known as brightlearn.ai. It's a free book publishing platform. We have over 55,000 books that have been created by over 10,000 authors, and you're free to download and share them all.
Yeah.
And I built that engine myself, and it also translates books into Spanish, and it creates full-length audiobooks. Okay, so that just demonstrates the power of AI in the hands of one person who wants to build something. In my case, you know, I'm all about human knowledge and sharing information. A lot of that's like heavily censored information about natural cures, you know, about living off-grid, things like that. So I have a pretty good handle on this situation. There's no question that AI will continue to replace entry-level jobs in many areas, entry-level coding, entry-level the legal profession. You'll see more and more, you know, I'm not talking about advanced, experienced attorneys, but entry-level will be taken over by AI. Customer service is already being overtaken by AI, both phone call customer service and email service, etc. But we're going to see AI move into more and more roles of middle managers, which is business decision making and logistics. And I understand this is a very hotly debated area, and some people are convinced that AI can't do anything. Well, that's not true, because I'm using it every day to do some pretty amazing things. By the way, all the book covers on that site I mentioned, every single book cover was generated by AI, and they're pretty amazing covers.
Yeah,
people love them. And I put out political cartoons every day and infographics every day at naturalnews.com. Those are all generated by AI. I mean, I tell them what to do. You know, I give them the prompt and the instructions, but then AI does the art. I used to pay a guy, you know, hundreds of dollars. Yeah. It would take a week to get one cartoon. Now it takes 30 seconds. So, and it costs, you know, 15 cents or something. So yes, AI is going to be another pressure of job replacement for some portion of society, but not for the, you know, for the innovators, for the entrepreneurs. They will always have a role. And also the farmers and the people who have mechanical skills, the plumbers, the welders, the pipe fitters, they will always have skills that are hands-on, that are really critical. But the truck drivers will be increasingly replaced. Transportation will be more automated with each passing year. You know, Tesla with a full self-driving feature set, they're about to roll out large semi-trucks in the United States. And it turns out that highway driving is something that can be pretty easily automated, even if the human driver takes over for the city part of it. Yeah. And, you know, and in your country, you know, the distances aren't nearly as far as they are in, let's say, Australia. Think about Australia, the long, long highway hauls, you know, for trucks. That is just ripe for automation. So you're going to see full self-driving highway rigs up and down the highways of Australia within just a few years.
Yeah. Electrically powered too, right?
Yeah, to a large degree, because the trucks can afford to carry all that battery mass with them. Yeah. In the trailer, you know, so they can do that.
AI from a control and surveillance point of view, I'm seeing humanoid robots now loading aircraft cargo holds, JAL. I mean, that replaces that kind of manual labor. And you mentioned entry level, but also there's the, I don't know, filtering of public speaking. There's the tracking of people, the surveillance of people. There's debanking. There's all those things. The power of AI against the people.
Yes.
What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that's my big concern, because it is being weaponized. We're seeing it in the U.S. where Palantir is doing a deal with the USDA to control farms or to have oversight on farms. And I have a lot of concerns about that. But you may recall that the company known as Anthropic had a the disagreement with the Pentagon, didn't want its technology to be used for mass surveillance or for automated killing machines, you know, Skynet Terminators, that kind of thing. And the Pentagon really attacked Anthropic over that. Meanwhile, other companies in the U.S., Google, Microsoft, OpenAI, they said, no problem. You can weaponize our technology all you want. Go for it. You know, they signed agreements with the Pentagon, and the Pentagon is absolutely building both automated surveillance and targeting systems. So, you know, automated target selection and autonomous killing machines, both drone based, flight based, but then ground drones. It won't be too long before we have, you know, those cute dog robots that everybody shows, the dancing videos. Yeah, they're not going to be dancing. They're going to be hunting down humans, whether on a battlefield somewhere else, or it may be turned against the people in some future sci-fi dystopian scenario, you know, because history can unfold quickly sometimes. So that technology will be extremely dangerous. I am obviously completely opposed to that use of the technology. I believe in using technology to create human abundance and to teach people how to be more human and more self-reliant. And yet we see our tech giants just moving in the direction that is anti-human.
Humanity, that's an interesting one. Here, and I'm sure you've had the same, during COVID, people were very nasty to people. It got really nasty to a very basic kind of almost spiritual level, let me put it that way. We were at each other. Why do you think that is? How do we get into that sort of confrontational sort of headspace?
Well, my perspective of what happened there with your government is it's a reflection of the Stanford experiment, the Stanford prisoner experiment. This is a classic experiment where I forgot the exact details, but they took a group of subjects and told half of them, you're going to play the role of prison guards. And then the other half, you're going to play the role of prisoners. And then play these roles. And they even had guard uniforms for those playing the role of prison guards. And it didn't take long before those role-playing the prison guards began to abuse those who were the prisoners. The role-play, I think this has an impact on government. When people role-play into positions of power over others, then they lose the humanity portion that they used to live, that they used to share. It's very easy. I think we saw this in all governments, frankly, all Western governments, even in Canada and Australia, UK, etc. Through COVID, we saw the rise of a level of extreme authoritarianism where people in government suddenly realized they had incredible power to force people to do insane things like total lockdowns and, you know, you can't go to church and your child can't go to school. Lock your child in their room for 2 weeks. You know, just craziness. And in America, we had in public schools, we had like music students in a music class. Each one was enclosed inside a little tent.
And they would have that. To
play your tuba in the tent. You know, like, what is this? Is insane. But then don't forget about Stockholm syndrome, which is when the prisoners worship their authoritarian captors. There's a lot of that going on too.
I want to talk about preparedness because I see the clock's always ticking. The way I see it, there are two forms of it. There's the psychological preparing, but also there's the physical things that you can do to, I don't know, get ahead of problems, let's say, that might arise. What is your advice? And I know that there's so much detail could go into this, but generally, for people listening here in New Zealand who are starting to think, well, how do I, if I want to get rid of my cell phone, how do I do that? If I want to learn a bit about, you know, on my patch, a bit of regenerative farming, how do I do that? What's the mindset to have, Mike?
In my opinion, the number one most important mindset is to decentralize from needing the centralized systems of control.
Right.
And do that in every area of your life. And, you know, it's interesting that many of the tech billionaires in the United States, they plan to flee to New Zealand if things get bad enough.
We've heard of the bunkers.
Right. That should be interesting to your audience to hear that. New Zealand is a place that is known for being very self-reliant and very self-capable, and also the level of ingenuity among New Zealanders to be able to, you know, repair the farm equipment yourself and keep on going. That, I mean, it's legendary, at least my understanding of
Thank you. Yeah, we'll take that.
Yeah. I mean, that's a valuable skill that's almost lost in today's younger generations in the United States. But I own tractors, and, you know, I live on a ranch, and I've had to learn a lot of skills that I never imagined I would learn. Like, oh, how do you change the fuel boot on a John Deere tractor built in 1976? Well, now yeah. I know, and it's more difficult than it should be. But anyway,
76 was a great year, by the way. 76 is one of my favorite.
76.
Yeah.
So and they well. Made good tractors in 76.
Yeah. They can't turn them off automatically.
That's right.
Models.
Yeah. And they're made out of steel. You know, I mean, I still have a 76 John Deere tractor. I think it's like a 4230 model or whatever it is. 100 horsepower at the PTO. And I keep it running on purpose for this very reason, because I want something that will run. And I store diesel fuel. That's another thing. I have a 500-gallon tank of diesel.
That'd be an essential, wouldn't it? Store
absolutely.
Fuel in this
yes.
in this situation. Yeah, sorry, jumping.
That's on. Another one. But always store it safely. You know, have a double-walled tank with the automatic ventilation. You know, spring-loaded vents and et cetera. Don't be a fool and try to just store gas in buckets or whatever. Like that's not going to go well.
Plastic bottles. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. But be wise about it. But then, you don't have to go full off grid. You don't have to be Robinson Crusoe or whatever. I mean, just learn to grow a little bit more food. Learn to sprout. Learn to save. You know, live within your means. Don't be indebted. Pay off the things that you can. Have a little bit of gold and silver on the side. You know, the monetary system, especially in the U.S., we don't trust the monetary system at all, right? I mean, the dollar's just losing value every single day, and they're printing it like mad. So those of us in the U.S., at least that know about this, you know, we're stacking gold and silver and other things like that. So that's my advice. Just decentralize and become as self-reliant as you can.
Okay, just to finish up, if I get the opportunity, I always try and ask this question because I think it's on a lot of people's minds. All these problems, a lot of it doesn't make sense. At the very essence, is this some kind of good, evil, ultimately, struggle? Do you see it like that? Many people do. You know, there's a good and evil, and it's a kind of spiritual warfare element to it.
Yeah.
You got any comment to make about that?
Yeah, there's definitely that element to this. We have, but what I notice is that, see, I think that most humans are initially just born in survival mode, you know, and as a child, you have a very narcissistic view of the world. And then through education and through culture and family, we learn to get along with other people and stop just demanding everything. You know, hopefully by the time you're older than seven, you're no longer just screaming like, give me lollipops, mommy, you know?
Yeah.
We learn through education and culture and then maturity and experience to live well with others. That is eroding. I think even at the highest level, I see our political leadership in America as reverting to the young child, the bully, the demanding child, the petulant child that says, give me everything. I win, you lose. I get everything. I'm going to take your food. You know, we are seeing that at a national level, and I'm seeing an erosion of polite society. There's more paranoia, there's more desperation, there's more crime. And, you know, it's probably no surprise to you that I'm armed at all times. I live in Texas, it's perfectly legal here, but it's incredibly common. I mean, not only am I armed, but all of my staff in my control room, they're all armed too. I mean, it's just a normal thing now because crime is so bad.
Wow.
And I'm friends with the sheriff, and the sheriff loves the fact that we're all armed. You know, that's become a common thing in certain areas of the United States. It's because what used to exist in society, the level of safety and politeness and civility, is largely gone. And I'm sad to say, I think we're looking at the decline of the American empire, and there will be a rebirth after the collapse one day. And this will affect, you know, every Western country to some extent, but I don't think that the way our society is structured today is sustainable. It's clearly not.
Wow. All right, Mike Adams, thank you so much for giving us some time from Texas. Nice to know you're all sort of ready to defend yourselves, because we don't have a gun culture here.
No, I know. I know. It's a different world.
But that's
world.
All kind of news to us, or a different feel to us, you know.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think a lot of us in America, we are fans of what you have in New Zealand in many ways. You know, there's a lot of people that have a very fond experience when they visit New Zealand. And yet, if you come to America, pretty soon you'll want a gun. You know, I mean, because it's a very different world. So just, you know, I just say be kind to everybody and try to promote empowerment and self-reliance and try to make the world a better place. You know, that's what I do every day. And I know you do too. And I value being on your show. I appreciate the invitation.
Well, thank you so much, as I say, for giving us some time. Hopefully we can chat again sometime, Mike.
Nice to
meet you.
And, nice to meet you.
And I'm sure our audience are going to be thrilled that you're on our channel. So thank you.
Thank you so much. A pleasure.
Start your day right with our organic hand-roasted whole bean coffee. Low acid, smooth and bold. Lab-tested and ethically sourced. Taste the difference. Only at healthrangerstore.com.